Season 2, Episode 13.
This is UX Podcast. I'm James Roy Lawson.
And I'm Pat Axbom.
And we are two humans here to help you push the boundaries of how user experience is perceived and boost your confidence in the work you do. We're based in Stockholm, Sweden, and you are listening to us all over the world, from Poland to Lithuania.
That was a very new intro, wasn't it?
I have no idea.
I've never seen that text before.
I think you read it last time.
Oh, really? Wow.
Is my guess.
That's a pretty cool one.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll say thank you. I presume I wrote it.
You wrote it. Today we are talking with innovator, artist, protagonist, activist, and positive provocateur, Maria Judis, co-author of Changemakers, How Leaders Can Design Change in an Insanely Complex World.
Maria has pursued a vision of intelligent, elegant, people-centered design throughout her professional life. Her expertise lies in fostering a vision and bringing people together to execute it. She knows how to overcome team silos and lead with influence instead of authority.
And we talked to Maria about what it takes to be a change maker, how change is emotional, how to battle change fatigue, and the importance of staying positive.
This interview was recorded at UXLX, which is a conference that is held every May in Lisbon, Portugal. Tickets are on sale now. Make sure you get yours before they sell out, which they usually do. Maria, what drives change is not something that's stays still. There's been multiple eras of different types of change, mm-hmm. or change drivers mm-hmm. Over the years. Where have we come from? Where are we heading?
Yeah, you know, first of all, thank you for letting me be on podcast. You know, I feel like I'm referring to you as the UX podcast boys.
Okay. We're very excited to have you on.
And I got very interested in this idea of change and why it's important to talk about it now. But as you mentioned, like, change has gone through, you know, change has existed for as long as we've existed, right? As long as the human race has existed, and we've adapted as human beings, and we've tried and failed and adapted, all of that is change. It's fundamental to who we are. And people have very different relationships to change in their everyday life. But if you really want to reflect on the impact of change on organizations, you can really look at eras based on the time. So Christopher and I kind of mapped this out when we were doing our research around change management, which I absolutely hate that word, change management. Mm-hmm. It's like I just want to like stab myself in the heart when I hear the word change management. So I'd rather say change leadership. Mm-hmm. But change management was the thing that people called, oh, this is working, this is no longer working, let's manage change to make it happen here. And it really started showing up, this idea of change management started showing up around in the 50s. You know, that was an era when everybody was really focused on efficiency and mass production, and change was very much about operations driven.
Yeah, the factory,
the optimization. It was all about like mechanical things. It was, you know, very linear in nature, and cause effect, linear. And so that was sort of the type of change that existed of the time. But then I think it was the 80s. That it's funny because I was in college in the 80s. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember the word yuppie.
Yes.
Right? That when I think of the 80s, I think of like the birth of yuppies.
At my university, someone actually spray painted on the way to the university on a door, some gates.
Yeah.
They spray painted welcome to the yuppie factory.
Yeah.
And an arrow pointing to the university.
There was a slang word in Sweden for the mobile phone was the yuppie teddy bear.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. For in the 80s or is that a current thing?
No, it was the 90s.
The 90s. Yeah. So that was a retro thing. Yeah. But like I came of age in the 80s. Mm. It was like in the US, it was Reagan years and he was like the Antichrist, right? Yeah. But there was this focus on just maximizing revenue.
Yeah.
Like there was this obsession with making money in the 80s. Mm. And so change management was really driven by that idea of maximizing your revenue. And so change management was really targeted specifically to that. And so profit-focused, scaled, and global, that was also the beginning where we were starting to think about the interconnectedness of countries and societies, right? Mm-hmm. And that went on for, I want to say, guessing 20 years. And smack dab during that period was the rise of the internet, right? So I started designing websites in 1993. Mm. So once the internet became a thing and got online, people really saw that there was a global connectedness. It was still kind of rudimentary, but people were starting to look very differently at societies as a global field. And that, so the finance-driven era of change management happened around then. And then tech bust, tech boom, and then the internet slowly started coming back. The rise of startups, the rise of technology, the bringing on the iPhone, like all of these seminal moments. I mean, we have been living in this era of tech-driven change. Mm, yeah. Engineers ruled the day.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah. Right? So most CEOs were either coming from a business background or an engineering tech background.
Mm. And of course, the underlying, so the speed of our connections, at least in Western world, Europe and America, we've seen how data connections in the 90s go from modem-based slow to being, huge. And that's that underlying tech.
Yes. Right.
Empowers other kind of change.
And that you bring a great point. Like things started moving faster, move fast and break things. Mm-hmm. At Mark Zuckerberg era, right? Like everything was get it done fast and we'll learn and we'll iterate, right? Without any focus on unintended consequences and harm, right? It was all about tech. Tech was God. And that was the last, 20 years. Mm. And then the pandemic was another sort of moment. And I think it was, I actually, even though it was hard and people died in masses, I also, there's huge tragedy, but it was also a gift because it was the only time where the entire world had to stop, right? It was a moment of change. And the, resistance to change and moving, there's the move fast and break things, but there was also a lot of like resistance to change. The pandemic forced us to change.
Yeah.
Whether we liked it or not, everybody had to rethink what it meant to do what they do for their families, for their companies, for their teams. Everybody had to leverage creativity because it was unprecedented. People were not relying on old models. New models had to be rebuilt. So everyone became a designer. Mm. And this ushered in the era of design-driven change. Mm. And why I think design is sort of the key to unlocking and unlocking what's possible, but also being deeply empathetic to the people that are impacted by the causes and the changes that we create. And so the world now is more connected, it's more systems driven, it's more inclusive. These, whether you resist that or not, we are much more interconnected and dependent on each other. And that's why I make the case that the qualities and the superpowers that designers have are incredible attributes to lead change at scale.
Mm-hmm. So are we fully transitioned now to an age of design-driven change? Or are we still in some kind of like gray zone between the era that's just coming to a close, the tech-driven era?
You can make this is more hypothesis than evidence-based, right? So I make the argument that the pandemic was this shift that we can't go back, right? There's going to be some things that are going to snap back, but they're not going to snap back to where they really were, because all of this experience is coming into is going to change the context to which we work. Mm. And when I talk about design driven, it's not like designers driven. Mm. It's design, the mindset of design strategy, the mindset of being creative, of being knowing your own change agency capabilities, the ability to take risks, the ability to use intuition and metrics, thinking about systems, focusing intently on people and their outcomes for people, and then getting shit done, right? Design is about actually getting shit done. It's not just about talking. It's about actually doing. Mm. And when you think about those qualities, those are designer-led qualities. So we are in an era of design-driven change that everybody could embrace, whether or not they think they're creative, because they are. We're all born creative. Depends on how they use those talents and to what end. Mm. So yes, I agree that we are firmly in design-driven era.
Okay.
And so that aspect of staying positive, I think that's one aspect that you push for in your book, that it's really important as a component of being a good change maker. You have to stay positive. And that's something that I feel a lot of people struggle with in today's world.
Yeah. You bring up a really great point about being hopeful. And it's hard to be hopeful when you think about all the shit that's happening in this world, right? You know, it's like, I could stay positive and then something horrible happens, you know, or, you know, this
because
person
of something
becomes
you were positive about.
Or,
I mean, that's the crushing thing when you've been positive about something. And it kind of betrays you.
It betrays you.
And
so
it's causes harm.
Change is highly emotional. Mm. And we are emotional beings, right? So you talk about the difference between hope versus fear. We all have that innately in us, right? As human beings, we are wired for survival. So from a neuroscience perspective, when something is different, when information that we see in front of us is contrary to what we have seen before, it triggers a reaction in our brain. And our brain is like, okay, this thing has happened. Do I need to be afraid or do I need to be happy? Right? So we are wired for, typically as human beings, we're wired for survival. Because, you know, as cavemen, we didn't want to be eaten by lions. So we go to this area of fear and protection first. We're more hardwired to think about the danger than we are the hope. So information comes in, and when we are fearful and we show up fearful, we shut down, right? We go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. Ideas are shut down because that's uncertain, that's new. Anything that's new is scary. So when we show up as human beings fearful, we present ourselves in a different way than if we show up hopeful. So if we go down this neuropath where it's like, okay, this is going to be a good thing. We call that the reward response in our brain. Suddenly our minds open up. That's where creativity lives. That's where open-mindedness lives. That's where idea generation lives. That's where design lives, right? And when we show up in that context, we are going to be solving problems in a very different way than if we show up fearful.
Yeah.
So this is about expanding the mind versus shutting down the mind. So as a change maker or in any context when you're interacting with human beings, it's important to figure out how are you showing up? Because if you show up fearful, your colleague's going to they're going to mirror that and they're going to show up fearful. And then suddenly you're going to have a very closed you know, conversation of what's not possible versus showing up expansive with, and then mirroring, and that person mirrors that their expansiveness, and then ideas are possible within that space.
That's so interesting, because there's the saying that people don't like change.
And
from one perspective, that's obviously true, because I don't like websites that change the positions of buttons from one day to the next. But we also always talk about how we ourselves want to grow and change and learn things. So we do enjoy change. And what you're saying is, to be a good change maker, I may myself have to realize that I have to change.
Yeah. How you show up matters. Mm. And that's a leadership truth that I learned by doing the research in this book, right? That the way we show up sends energy or mirror neurons, it's called mirror neurons, where people mirror the energy field of others, right? Mm. And so it's really critical for you to be aware of what you bring to the table. But you just also made a great good point, like that word change can be triggering, depend on the context, right? Because, you can say people are afraid of change, but designers love change. Yeah. That's what they're driven by change. The harder the problem, the more excited we get, right? And so there's a saying in the book that nobody hires a design team to maintain the status quo. No matter what, you know, if you're just doing, you know, wireframes on a sheet of paper, people are hiring you to do something different than existed before. So the very definition of design is change.
Yeah.
Therefore, change can be designed. So that's the framework to think about.
But as a change maker, you've said that I need to keep a positive approach to change. How do I maintain that kind of checks and balance so that I don't kind of like blindly plow on making change when it isn't a good thing, when the fear was actually the right thing to kind of react to?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not saying to never be fearful, right? Because as human beings, we have to survive. So we have to be fearful. So it's not always a bad thing to be fearful. If you're walking down a dark alley, an unlit alley in the middle of a night, it's probably really important for you to have your guard on, right? So,
and it makes you care about the unintended consequences.
You need both of these in order to be a human being. But I coach leaders, and a big part of my coaching practice is for people to become more self-aware.
Right.
So when you are more self-aware, you have more clarity in terms of the consequences of your actions and behaviors, and you have more facility to. And so, for me, because I've been doing this work a long time now, I can clearly see now when I trigger people, right? Their whole tone changes. Maybe their body language changes. They might argue with me. They might have an angry reaction. They might withdraw from me, right? And all of that is knowing that I triggered that. And so I now have the capacity to see, I triggered this person. They're going to shut down or they're going to fight. So now I need to readjust my interaction with that person. A big part of change maker is really recognizing, are you bringing people along for this journey or are you creating resistance? Right. And so a big part of growing as a change maker is to figure out ways in which you can have a shared vision. You can have compassion and empathy for the people who may or may not disagree with you, and to figure out how you can, I say, like, move up the mountain together. You know, change making is a lot like mountain climbing. Everybody has their own pace. How do you recognize the pace? Some people, in the book, there's this great framework that I learned in coaching called leapers, bridge builders, and tradition holders. So you can look at a system and you can identify what's their relationship to change in the context that they're in? So it might be an initiative like when I was at Autodesk and I came in and I was really pushing, you know, and evangelizing the power of design, and I activated the design teams all over the world. They were super excited by me being there. They were like on board with whatever I wanted to do, right? I was a person in power. I'm going to join your team. Help me achieve your mission. I'm all in. These are people we call leapers. These are people who leap to make that change happen. And they're usually the early adopters. They get super excited about the change. They want to get things. They want to start things. So that's the leapers. The second group is what we call the bridge builders. And like I like to, you know, thinking in my own experience, like engineering teams tend to be bridge builders. These are people who are really data driven. That they're gonna hang back a little, and they're like, okay, I hear your point, but show me the evidence. I need evidence before I can believe in your mission, right? So these are people who are not resistors, but they're not adopters. So what's your strategy for those people who need to see proof that your ideas are sound? And how do you engage with them differently than the leapers? That's the second tier. The third tier, which are the group that we are the most annoyed with in organizations, they're called the tradition holders. These are people who are who've been in the company a long time, they have change fatigue. They've seen people like me come and go all the years. And they just sit back and like, yeah, you're going to fail. And I'm going to dance on your grave when you fail, right? They're going to be quiet, or they might not be, right? And these are the people who are waiting for the moment when you're the most vulnerable to like, to kill you, right? Dead. And so as change makers, like in my early days, I would just like ignore them. It's like, they're not my people. I'm going to ignore them. They're not that important to me. They're edge group, right? But when you are a change maker, you're going to have peaks and valleys. And when you're in a dip, those tradition holders can come out and get you fired, right? See? You know, see what that person did? They failed, which failure is inevitable. And so how do you engage with those people differently? So I'm kind of coming full circle about self-awareness. How are you showing up? But then how are other people, what's their behavior, their relationship to change? And what's your strategy to engage with them differently so that they don't become all-out resistors?
I want to know that now.
Well, then you're going to have to read the book. I know you bought the book. I know you got to take it off your shelf. You got to read about it. There's strategies to deal with all of those people.
What I've gathered from that then is that you see those resistors, that group, the traditionalists, that they are the ones that are hardest to work with.
They are the hardest to work with.
Whereas you're drawn automatically to the bridge builders because they're already kind of, they're open to change,
but you have to prove your
case.
But
you have to work in it. Yeah, whereas with the traditionalists, they're closed to change.
Right. And the leapers are like, I'm going to jump off the cliff. I don't care if I have a safety net, right?
So that makes sense to me.
And the leapers, one of the things about leapers is they're great starters, but they get bored if you start they're all about the new. When it no longer becomes new, they are no longer interested.
Which is a mirror of the traditionalists.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the tradition holders are in for the long term. So if you can, and they are the wisest because they have been in the organization a really long time. So they have really valuable information that if you could gain their trust, you're going to know where the bodies are buried. You're going to know about things that have tried and been failed and why they failed. And if you can get them to support you, that is a much deeper commitment than the leapers who are going to they're one night stand people.
But I guess it also feeds the leapers because you're then
you got to bring everybody along.
And you're releasing kind of, I suppose, new challenges to the leapers because now
then you're also
revealing.
A bridge builder. Being a bridge between those entities.
You got to bring them all along. And this is where, awareness shows in. And I think it's The other thing is, you know, my observation in doing this work for the last couple of years is, like, as design leaders, we're the empathy people. We are the relentless customer advocates. We will go to bat for our customers. We love them and care about them deeply. We typically do not extend that same amount of love and empathy to our peers, right? Or our adversaries or our leaders, right? We either are skeptical, we might be angry that we don't get respect. Like, there's all sorts of other things that come up. And I feel like if we can practice compassion and have the same amount of empathy for the people that we serve through customer experience, and we can apply that with the people that we work with on a day-to-day basis, even the ones we don't agree with, that is going to, I believe, make the world a better place.
I have to follow up on that, because we're talking a bit about resistance now as well. And something that you mention in your book is about, when you talk about finding a fit and finding the right problem, is also finding the right culture, where the a culture that isn't too rigid.
Yes.
So you're actually actively looking for something that isn't too resistant to what you're trying to do.
Yeah, we talk a lot about what we call setting the conditions for success. What are the foundations for success, right? That need to be there, or we also might push them aside because they may not exist, right? So we wanted to explicitly say, these are the things that you need in order to be successful, right? So the foundations of success, there's a couple of things. There's making sure that you have an executive sponsor who supports your mission, has your back. There's having a clear direction for change that's clear. It doesn't have to be explicit, but is there a direction there from leadership that you can, that they want you to make that change happen? And then the third is making sure you have time, money, and the right people, right? And I talk about this in my talks, because it's like, you need all this. And they're like, yeah, people are like, yeah, that's like a, that's a dream, right? It's like, look, these are the conditions for success. If you don't have them, you will be pushing water upstream, or you need to reset your expectations. So it's not like change is impossible if you don't have the conditions for success. It just means that you're going to have to change your expectations about what is possible. The same is true for organizational structure and company culture. So, and so to pay attention to that, again, like, we get really excited about joining a new company. Sometimes we put, we don't, we're not listening to our intuition that the culture might not be ready for us. And as designers, we all know the difference between working in a company that understands design as a mature function versus those organizations that think of design as just supporting scrum teams, right? We have seen and lived that world. It's not to say that it's impossible to make change in a company that is more resistant to change. It's that you need to be realistic about what is possible within the context of that culture. And the change making is such hard. It is hard work. It is worthy, but it, it takes a lot of emotional, it comes at an emotional cost, because you will fail. It is not, you don't get a prize at the end of the race. There is no end, you know? And so you have to be, feel good about progress that you've made all along. And so you have to reset and say, what is my intention, what I hope to get out of this? And if a company is toxic, it's going to be harder for you to be successful than in a company that is more open to change.
This is also, though, I guess, inputs into how you need to then recalibrate your timeline.
Yes,
because some of the things you're talking about there, like, you know, having the executive partner, then, you know, the go ahead from the organization, management, and so on, and then a budget combined with culture. You know, the current status of the culture and the organization, the firm. Depending on where you are on all these bits, I mean, you might have very unrealistic expectations of change.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you have to take stock of what are the conditions that I'm working in? What's my intention here? What is possible? And a lot of people always ask me, hey, do you have to be a VP of design to be a change maker? Mm. You do not. You can be a change maker if you're an IC, if you can employ these techniques if you are a junior designer, all the way up to the senior designer. Mm. But I did interview 40 plus people from not only from design, but from business, from social justice, from education, from politics. I interviewed 40 people that I respected for what they were able to do in this world. And these are the core themes that came up. And an executive, 100% of the people that I talked to talked about the need to have an executive sponsor.
Yeah.
Somebody who's in a position of power, who is going to believe in you, and you are going to have good outcomes, and they're going to support you, because when times get bad, you need somebody to have your back. Mm. And that could be your immediate boss. It could be your CEO. It could be anywhere. But you're going to need somebody who's in a position of power who's going to support you as a change maker.
Mm. You can't do change alone.
Cannot do it alone, and you can't do it without the support of people in power.
Yeah, and this is so useful, because I expect a lot of people are struggling and thinking that they're doing something wrong, but there are pieces to the puzzle that they haven't found yet, and they maybe need to refocus their attention to getting those things in place before they try to make the change.
I like to use the analogy. So when I want you guys to go back in time when you were dating people. Right. And you found somebody, that person's hot. Mm. You're like, I like this person. You know, and of course you're like, there's this attractiveness, and you're like, is this going to go further? You know, the more that you get to know the person, first you kind of ignore all the blinders. You're just sexually attracted to that person, right? Mm. It's like, I don't care if that person's an asshole. I really want that body right in front of me, right? So, right? But then as you get to know that person, all these other things start creeping in that you don't like, right? And you might go, I always say, like, there's a 3-week period of that where in 3 weeks you start asking yourself, is this going to go further, or I'm going to dump this person, right? Mm. So you go to the 3 weeks and you're starting to really get to know the person. You might like move in with them. You're going further and further. You might be marrying them, right? The further you go into that relationship, you see the things that you don't agree with that bug you. And instead of like accepting it, you say, I'm going to change that person. Yeah, I don't like that thing about that person, so I'm going to change it, right? And then you're in a marriage, you're with a relationship counselor, a marriage therapist, and like that's your spouse says, she just wants me to change. I this is who I am, and all she wants me to do is be like her, and I'm not like her. It is the same analogy when it comes to change making, is that we assume that our way of the world is the right way, and if we could only change their perspective to be more like me, I'm going to get what I want.
Mm-hmm.
But the end of the day, that's not how people work.
Right.
At the end of the day, we live in a society where everybody brings their own shit. And you have to find a way through a relationship where you have shared goals and vision. And you hope that that shared goal and vision outweighs the differences and the things that annoy you about that person. Mm. So you could stay in your marriage. Mm. So that's the analogy that I like to use.
Yeah. So it's not about moving fast, it's about moving together.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Climbing that mountain together.
Yeah.
Looking back to that analogy as well.
Thank you for being on the show, Maria.
I liked how you wrapped it up. Mm. Let's all be together.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Something I do believe we tend to forget, and the point that Maria makes as well now, is that we forget that the people inside our organizations are also human beings. We don't always treat them with the same care and compassion as we do end users when we are designers. But of course, we always need to tend to and cater to the different needs, abilities, the context of the people we're working with to allow them to get on the same page as us.
I think this is us missing at times that we are designing within a system. And, you know, the actual users or the people who are experiencing the experiences we design are as much a part of the system as the colleagues in our team, as the stakeholders, as, you know, everyone involved in it.
Exactly.
And you're right. I think we do sometimes treat people a little bit too differently in that system.
And we expect things that we shouldn't always expect, and we get frustrated, meaning that we influence the people we work with, which means that they sometimes aren't able to perform as well as they could if we met them or allowed them to be someone else in certain situations, as in workshops and stuff like that.
Mm. We've also discussed this kind of idea when it comes to designing or developer experience, for example.
Yeah.
That, you know, thinking about when you're working as a designer with engineers, that this is a touch point. you as a designer interfacing to the engineering, that in itself is something that can be designed and considered.
Exactly.
And you can have loads of empathy for that situation.
Yeah, it's hugely important, because if you're not able to communicate your findings and your understanding of the problem space and your ideas for the solution to the developers, then you failed. Then it doesn't matter what your insights are if you aren't able to connect with the developers.
Yep. And ties us into what Maria was saying about the leapers, bridge builders, and, you know, tradition holders, that, you know, they can be all different types of people in your system of change.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can bring a developer, an engineer along with you that is a traditionalist, then, you know, you're improving this, and you're making a better platform for change.
Exactly. And now I'm thinking of what she also said about everybody having their own pace, and realizing that, well, I sometimes love to move fast in some areas and slowly in other areas, and other people want to do the opposite. And I have to realize that, well, when I want to move fast and I understand things quickly, not everybody does. So I actually have to slow down, because otherwise I won't help people get to where I am.
And you have to also consider about how you might have to reframe things or even repackage things so that it is more consumable or approachable or absorbable, if that's even a word, for the other people that haven't, you know, come to a certain state as you have as quickly.
Exactly. At the same time, as I have to allow myself to change sometimes as well.
Yeah. Ties us in nicely to, I think, the whole idea of time and this and change. And Marie, she says about, in answer to my question, we're talking about the condition, setting the conditions for success, and how you need to maybe adjust your expectations depending whether the conditions for change or success aren't in place. And, you know, that made me think a bit more about how much time it could take at times to ensure you've got the conditions for success. I mean, Maria, she talked about, what did we have there? She said you needed an executive sponsor, time and money, and the right people. Mm. And these were her prerequisites for succeeding.
Right.
And, you know, when you're talking about times for projects, times for kind of like, you know, implementing change, that's one thing. That's from that point, the conditions of success are met going forward. But getting to that point can take time.
Exactly.
and these things that, you know, we talked about in the interview, getting an executive sponsor, in some organizations, that could take you, you know, literally months, if not years.
Right.
And then the budgeting process, equally so. I mean, a lot of companies, especially larger ones, maybe we're talking yearly budget setting. So you might have to wait until next October before you can get the kind of sign off on that to be able to start in the following, you know, January after. And then the right people.
Exactly.
Anyone that's been involved in recruitment knows that that can take a lot of time. And then you have that whole thing where you get the right people and then someone leaves.
Yes, I've been in projects like that, definitely.
Yeah. So you effectively, yeah. It's kind of like you never really have maybe, I mean, what's the right people? I mean, it's one does. It's a moving goalpost. Mm.
And it's rather humbling then, I think, just what we're saying now, just to realize that it takes so much time and you just need to be able to stick with it if you want to have that change happen. So being a change maker is really hard. It's hard work.
It involves recalibrating, doesn't it? And being able to understand different types of success, I guess. That it doesn't always have to be the big success. That you're how you frame it can mean that you make good steps forward that are, you know, aligned with the context you're working in.
Right. Reminds me of how we in coaching we always talk about celebrating your small wins, because you tend to forget how far you've come because you always are trying to reach somewhere else.
Yep, definitely.
So when you started talking about recommended listening, James, I just started scrolling back and I put in some search terms and found a really, really old episode, 22.
No, 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, this is now, you're going back almost 12 years.
Yeah. Okay. And it has, the title has the keyword change. James and Pat change names. And that's probably how I found it. And we discussed web management 12 years ago. Yeah. We take three recent examples where organizations have undertaken major changes to their web presence and investigate how it all went.
I don't think it went great.
And I mean, I haven't listened back to this one, but apologies for the sound quality 14 years ago. Or 12, yeah. Jesus.
12 years ago. Yeah. I'm going to listen to that one and see what it's like.
To it.
So if you would like me or Pat as part of your next conference, event or in-house training, then we are willing to do workshops, talks and courses to inspire you to grow as individuals, teams and organizations. So just get in touch with us and you can do that by emailing hey@uxpodcast.com.
Remember to keep moving.
See you on the other side.
James, why is Peter Pan always flying?
Oh, I don't know, Pat. Why is Peter Pan always flying?
He never lands.
Oh.